Sati had been persuaded to set off to school. Once Timothy was on his feet and leaning against the wall of the shower with the water hitting his head, Yasmina had gone to her youngest child and had assured her that Daddy was fine, and that mothers and daughters sometimes argued, which was what she'd witnessed with Missa before she left with Justin. These things happened on occasion, and Sati was not to worry because Yasmina would speak to Missa that very afternoon and bring her home. As for her father, he'd only been asleep, darling, and it was a complicated matter to rouse him because he'd taken a pill last night. So Sati had reluctantly gone off to school, clutching her Hello Kitty lunchbox. That had left Yasmina able to deal with Timothy. She returned to the bathroom. "You could have died," were her first words to her husband. "How much more do you want to put us through? Sati has watched her older sister die. She's just watched Missa leave this house with her belongings. And now this, you, virtually unconscious with your wife beating on your body to bring you round. I might have had to use the naloxone, and she might have seen me do it. Is that what you want? Is that where we're heading?"
"We're already there," had been his mumbled reply.
She'd wanted to jump into the shower, to grab onto his curling, steely hair and beat his head against the tiles on the wall. Instead she cried, "You're cursing us! No wonder Missa can't stand to be here. No wonder she's left." He opened his eyes at this, raising his head and putting his bloodshot gaze upon her.
"At least she has the courage to do something, yes. There's more than I can say for the rest of us."
Which made her wonder if she'd ever known him. Which made her watch him at the clinic, during the day with a window between them, just waiting for the moment when he'd cadge more pills. But she could not remain and monitor all his movements because she had to keep her promise to Sati. So she cancelled her last four appointments for the day. The penultimate place she wished to head was to Blist's Hill Victorian town, but the ultimate place was to the home of Justin Goodale's family, so she got into her car and drove out of Coalbrookdale. Yasmina went directly to the candlemaker's shop, but there she found another young woman in Missa's place, explaining to a small contingent of tourists how candles had been fashioned in the days of the Victorians. When she looked in her direction, Yasmina mouthed, "Missa?" The girl paused to re-enter the present century, saying,
"Hi, Dr. Lomax. She's at the fish and chip shop. Mary Reed got ill, and Miss is the only one on the grounds just now who knows how to work the fryer properly."
Yasmina retraced her steps to one of the main streets of the town. The shop she was looking for advertised itself easily enough, with a tempting scent of frying food and a sign that read, "Fried fish and chipped potatoes. Only the finest beef dripping used." Inside the place, Missa had her back to the shop counter on which a line of paper cones stood, waiting for chips, and four customers stood, waiting for the cones. Missa was offering them no explanation about her work. What could one actually say about immersing chipped potatoes into hot oil? When she turned and saw Yasmina waiting among the others, Missa gave no outward reaction. She merely filled the cones as requested and added to them two orders of the battered cod. The customers left happily, and Yasmina approached the counter. She ordered a cone of chips, and when given them, she said to her daughter,
"When will you be free, Missa? I'd like to have a word." "We've said everything possible on every subject," Missa said. "Nevertheless, when are you free? I doubt you would be very happy to have me lurking in the shop waiting for you."
Missa pressed her lips together as she considered this, finally saying,
"My final break is in 20 minutes. If you want to wait, that's fine. You can always look up Justin for a private word in the meantime. I know you like to do that."
Yasmina refused to be drawn into defending herself. She said,
"I'll wait at the carousel, my dear,"
and with her cone of chips in her hand, she left the shop. She dropped the wretched stuff into a rubbish bin as soon as she saw one. The carousel wasn't far from the big refreshment pavilion, and there were benches nearby where parents could sit and watch their children on the antique ponies. Yasmina found a seat on one and took in what composed the Victorian funfair. There were 5 stalls, featuring games of chance, but the carousel was the fair's most popular feature for families having a day out with small children. There weren't a great number enjoying the galloping ponies on this day, but those that were waved and laughed as they rose and fell with a cheerful music while watchful parents and grandparents stood nearby. Taking this in, Yasmina's vision blurred. Her own daughters had ridden those ponies. They too had laughed and waved. Missa especially had loved the carousel, had loved the entire Victorian town. Yasmina had encouraged this love with picture books and paper dolls. She merely hadn't ever thought that Victoriana in this particular fashion would end up as her daughter's life work. She waited patiently. She told herself that she would listen to Missa, instead of arguing with her or attempting to cajole her, She wanted to do this, she told herself, for if she didn't manage some sort of peace with her daughter here and now, there would be no resolution to anything. When Missa at last arrived, she plopped down onto the bench. She, too, took in the carousel.
"How you loved it," Yasmina remarked. "You used to tell me that you would be in charge of that carousel one day. Do you remember?"
"We've beaten Blist's Hill to death as a subject," was Missa's tart reply.
"I'm not here to talk about Blist's Hill."
"So what is it that you've come to say? That you're sorry you promised rubbish weddings and rubbish honeymoons and rubbish dream cottages? Is that why you're here? Linda was impressed, by the way. She didn't know you and Dad have access to those kinds of funds."
"That's what you call her now. No longer Mrs. Goodale, is it?"
Missa brushed a non-existent hair off her face.
"We've discussed whether it's going to be Mum after Justy and I marry, but that doesn't feel right to either of us. She said Linda's fine. She prefers it to Mother Goodale or Mother Linda, which she said would make her feel like someone in a convent."
Yasmina had no wish to extend further a conversation on the topic of Missa's future with the Goodale clan. She said,
"I was wrong in what I did. I apologize. I'm here to ask you to come back home. Sati is terribly upset by what's happened."
"Which part of what happened?
The part where she knows you've tried to use Justin to get me to do your bidding, or the part where I called a halt to it all?" "This thing. You're leaving as you've done. This isn't good for her to see at her age. I believe you understand that, Missa."
"Not good?"
Missa's face settled into that hardness that Yasmina found so disturbing. She said, "We're not setting a bad example, if that's what you're worried about, Mum. You can tell Sati I have my own bedroom. I'm not sleeping with Justin." She looked away at the carousel and the laughing children. She took a moment before she went on with, "I still want what I always wanted, what you made me want, matter of fact. White wedding, virginity, pure as the wool of an Easter lamb." Yasmina said,
"Sati's lost Janna. We've all lost Janna, 12 years old. You mean everything to her."
Missa gave a short laugh.
"What I mean to Sati isn't important to you, Mum."
"That's not true."
"Whatever you say. Anyway, me living with the Goodales? This is only till we have our own place, me and Justin. We're going to look for a cottage to let. We're thinking about one above the river, in Jackfield. It has only one bedroom, but we think it might do for now. Of course, Justy will sleep on the sofa till the blessed day arrives. No worries, like always, Mum. We'll get a bigger place eventually, but that'll take time. Justy's business is going well, but so far his output only pays for supplies, the cost of letting the building at the Tower Museum, and a bit of extra. Once he's able to hire a helper, production will increase. That person won't have as much talent as Justin, of course, but whoever it is can help with the work that's not so detailed."
She looked directly at Yasmina.
"You never thought of him as someone with talent, did you?" "Sati is my concern now," Yasmina said. "I understand that you will do what you will do. Everyone has made that perfectly clear to me, but Sati needs you. That's all this is, something I'm asking you to do for Sati."
"Tell Sati that if we take the cottage, she can come to us," Missa said. "It won't be long and then she'll be free."
"Have we come to that, Missa? Is this truly what you want to say to your mother?"
Missa shook her head. It was one of those maddening movements that declared Yasmina's questions to be exactly what Missa had come to expect. It was also one of those maddening movements that Yasmina wanted to strike out against. When, she wondered, had her daughter begun this change of personality? More, why had she begun it?
"You would think that, Mum," Missa said. "You take everything as an insult, but all I did was state a fact."
Yasmina looked away from her then, at the endless spinning of the carousel and the children who were so enchanted by the fantasy ride it gave them upon the backs of its artificial ponies.
"Then there's nothing else to be said, my dearest."
"Stop calling me that. I'm not your dearest."
Yasmina turned back to her.
"Of course you are. Despite all this, you remain my child, my dearest child. This thing between us now, it will pass. Perhaps not exactly as I wish it to."
"Not exactly, Mum."
"What exactly does not exactly look like to you? We're going to get married. I know you'll still try anything you can think of to stop us, but we will get married. Can you understand that, Missa?"
Everything Yasmina was feeling created a pressure against her chest. So great was it that for an instant she wondered if her heart was failing.
"I understand. There isn't a point to my resisting any longer. I see that. But will you tell me why the urgency of it all? That's what I cannot understand. The urgency, the rush, as if you feel you must prove something, as if there's a need for haste."
"We want it like that," she said. "We want it soon. We want it now, because it's been decided. Because I've decided. Not for you, not for Dad, not for Sati or Granny or even for Justin. I've decided for once, and I've decided for me."
She stood then, and Yasmina saw with surprise that Misa appeared to be struggling not to weep. She saw it in the difficulty she had with what she said next.
"It's what I want, and it's what I'm doing. That's all it is."
But it wasn't. It absolutely wasn't. Yasmina knew it, and she could see it. And then the sudden clarity came to her. Yasmina said, so close to a whisper that she wasn't sure her daughter could hear her,
"You're engaged in a punishment, aren't you?"
"Not everything in life is about you," was her reply.
"No, no, you misconstrue," Yasmina said. "I don't mean you're punishing me. I mean you're punishing yourself. I just don't know why, but it's the truth, isn't it?"
"And not every truth is yours either," she responded.
Wandsworth, London. She hadn't stayed long. One glance had been enough to tell her exactly what the Detective Chief Inspector's spate of illness was all about. She'd come to Wandsworth with, God help us, soup and sandwiches purchased on the way. She'd said, thrusting them towards Isabel,
We hope you feel better soon."
Isabel had felt the accusation of spying rise to her tongue. She felt,
"You're a little copper's narc, aren't you?"
looking for a way into the air. She had little doubt that while Dorothea Harriman might keep mum about what she'd discovered when she was anywhere near the officers currently under Isabel's command, she would never keep mum round the one officer whom Isabel wanted least to know about her condition. When she'd managed to clear Harriman off the premises, she poured the soup straight down the drain. The sandwiches she stuffed into the rubbish. She didn't need either, nor did she want the concern they represented. She'd phoned Bob repeatedly throughout the rest of the day. He'd not responded. She'd had to attempt getting Sandra to speak to her, which she finally accomplished round 6 o'clock. She'd only made herself one fortifying drink in the intervening hours. She had no intention of missing another day of work because she was the master of her basest desires. Sandra answered her mobile with,
"Please stop ringing me, Isabel. I'm answering this once to let you know I'll not answer again. If you want to deal with anyone at all, you'll deal with Bob, not me. How is Lawrence?"
"Resting and recovering.
He wasn't particularly happy to know his mother would not be able to drive to see him, but Bob managed to get him past it well enough."
"Did he give him my message?"
"I don't know what your message was, and I certainly didn't think to ask Bob if you sent any fond words to your own child."
"Is that Mummy? Is that Mummy? Can I talk to Mummy?"
James's voice was so filled with hope that it made a rent in the fabric with which Isabel girded herself. She said,
"Let me talk to James, please. Bob has told me. I'm sure he has. I'd like to speak with him anyway."
"I don't think so, Isabel."
"Darling, isn't that film still in the DVD player? You know which one. We were watching it last night. I want to talk to my mum. I want to tell her about Lawrence."
"She knows all about Lawrence, James."
"Don't punish him like this," Isabel said. "I don't blame you for wanting to hurt me. But James has done nothing except have the misfortune of being born my son. Let me talk to him, please."
That appeared to get through to Bob's wife, because after a moment, James's voice came over the phone, saying,
"Are you coming to Maidstone, Mum? When are you coming?"
"As soon as I can, darling.
Is Lawrence going to get well?"
"Of course he is. You're not meant to worry. Dad's worried, I can tell."
"Oh, that's all right, James. Parents always worry. We even worry when you tie your shoes in case they're not done properly and you trip over your laces. But if you want to worry, make it twin brother worry."
"I don't know what that is."
"It's the worry about how you'll make Lawrence feel extra special when he comes home."
There was a silence. She could picture his face, screwed up in concentration as he worked on this. Finally he said,
"It's just that I don't know how to do that."
"Well, let's see.
Do you have something special that you know he likes?"
"You mean something to give to him?"
"Maybe something you haven't exactly wanted to share with him."
"My brontosaurus. We went to the museum, the natural history one, and Dad said we could each have a dinosaur, and Lawrence chose the T-Rex, but that's what everyone chooses, so I chose the brontosaurus. We took him to school, but everyone wanted to know about mine because they already knew about T-Rexes. Well, everyone does, don't they? Because of films. No one could believe that the brontosauruses were gentle, so I got asked lots of questions while no one asked Lawrence anything, and he was annoyed. I could share my brontosaurus with him. For a while, I mean. I wouldn't want it to be permanent."
"So you could share it for a while," Isabel said. "That would be quite nice, James. You could have it waiting on his bed when he gets home."
"Course,"
he said, and he sounded thoughtful.
"I could give it to him, couldn't I, Mum? I could make it a forever present. That would make it truly special."
"That's completely up to you, James. Whatever you decide."
"When are you coming here, then?"
"As soon as I absolutely positively can."
"Tonight?"
"I'm not able tonight, darling. But soon, I promise. Very soon."
A moment later, Sandra was back on the phone, saying,
"I hope you didn't promise him anything. You've done that 1,000 times before now, and the broken promises—"
"I said I'm coming, and I'm coming," Isabel cut in. "James knows it, and you can pass it along to Lawrence as well."
"And have you a message for Bob?"
Sandra's voice had taken on an unpleasant archness. Isabel wanted to say, tell him he didn't exactly hit the wife jackpot in either of his marriages, but she refrained. She said,
"Please ask him to ring me when he gets home. I'm concerned about Lawrence."
"Oh, I'm sure you are," was Sandra's reply before she ended their conversation. Isabel sat on the sofa from where she'd made the call, staring, as she'd done before, at the hideous, unpainted concrete wall outside that acted to retain the earth and the pavement above it. She thought about what Sandra had said, and she acknowledged it for the truth it was. She had broken promises to the boys. "We'll do this together. We'll do that together. I'll come for a Sunday afternoon in fair weather, and we'll take a boat on the river. We'll prowl round Leeds Castle. We'll go to Rye for the day." She was a veritable catalogue of broken promises. She'd given her word and gone against it left, right and centre. She'd done this not only to her boys, but to Bob and Sandra and to her colleagues as well. Worst of all, she'd broken nearly every promise she'd made to herself. "One drink only tonight, Isabel." "Oh, all right. Then only two. Don't put those bottles in your bag. For God's sake, don't store them inside your desk." The list was long. It was probably endless. A walk, she thought. She would take a walk. That was the best way to start to keep the promise she made to herself at the moment that she would not drink tonight or tomorrow morning. Once outside in the evening air, she made for Heathfield Road. To get there, she had to walk along the grim southeastern boundary walls of Wandsworth Prison. From there she was on to Magdalen Road, and it was there the thirst first came upon her. She told it no. No now, and not tonight. She picked up the pace till she was on Trinity Road, with its shops and newsagents and occasional cafes and an off-license that she frequented. The urge was as great as her thirst, but she said no again. She crossed the road and hurried north to where she would have access to Wandsworth Common. There were trees to walk beneath, there were spots where the occasional spontaneous football match was played. There was once a baseball game going on, although she'd been told it wasn't baseball but softball, which was apparently a different thing. She set off on the first path she came to. She was walking briskly. The evening was mild, and there were people about who were greatly enjoying it. A young couple was having a picnic on the lawn. A family had launched 3 small sailboats on one of the ponds. At a nearby bench, 2 girls sat side by side, gazing with fascination at their smartphones. On another bench, an elderly woman with stockings, making ripples on her ankles, was pulling crumpled bread from a bag and feeding pigeons. That was Isabel Ardrey in her 70s, Isabel thought. Alone, in a society where people were never alone, left to feed birds because there was simply nothing else open to her. Then,
"Granny! Gran!"
and 2 little girls came running to the woman, their parents not far behind them. The husband called,
"Mum, pigeons will eat all of Somerset if they're given the chance. Feed the swans instead."
The woman scooped up her granddaughters. They covered her face with kisses. She kissed them back. They laughed together. So it wouldn't even be that, Isabel thought. She had to get away from this place before despair overtook her and did not let go. She walked, farther and faster, and without looking to see where she was. She was terrified that she'd notice another off-license if she paid attention to her surroundings. If that happened, she was lost indeed. She was taken aback when she saw that she'd walked as far as the Thames. As she hadn't even set out in the river's direction, she was even more taken aback when she saw that the bridge spanning it was not the Wandsworth Bridge. For a moment, she was clueless, till a bookshop with which she was familiar told her she was on Putney High Street, which meant the bridge was Putney Bridge, carrying motorcyclists, cyclists and pedestrians towards Parsons Green on the north side of the river. She couldn't stop. She knew if she did so, the danger would be as enormous as the need, so she headed towards the bridge, and she only slowed when she saw that she was coming to a church, and when she knew that she could not walk any farther as pure exhaustion from the day was upon her. A sign outside gave the time for services. Evensong was being held. Isabel reached a decision from among the 2 possibilities available to her: drink or pray. She understood that she was in a physical state from which God could not deliver her, but there were so few choices available just now, she grasped at the straw she knew Evensong was. The service had already begun when she entered. There were very few people present. In these days of secularism, with people attending church only for Christmas, Easter, marriages and funerals, Isabel wondered if priests became discouraged. She would become so, she knew. She entered a pew. She sat. Others were kneeling, and she realized what an odd duck she was in this place, as she'd not been inside a church since the twins' christening. She dimly heard the priest intoning some kind of prayer. She came in on, "Like lost sheep, we have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have offended against thy holy laws. We have left undone those things which we ought to have done. And," she closed her eyes, "she would not listen. There was no God. There was nothing at all, just the vast emptiness of space in which everyone floated, trying to find a place where alone was not as terrible as it seemed, since death was alone, and death was where they were all heading anyway, and we have done those things which we ought not to have done." She closed her eyes. She brought her fist to her mouth. Then, "Spare thou those, O God, who confess their faults." She couldn't listen, because she couldn't bear to hear. She opened her eyes and saw the priest in his vestments, and it seemed that he was looking directly into her heart. This wasn't possible, since she was so far back in the nave, but she could feel his gaze boring into her, and it wasn't him at all, but then who was it, God, or her conscience, or an accusation? She pulled one of the handmade kneeling pillows from the back of the pew in front of her. She dropped it onto the floor. The words went on, and they sought to teach her, but teaching her wasn't what she needed, although it appeared to be what she was offered. She struggled for a moment to slide off the bench. No one else was kneeling at this point in the service, but it didn't matter. She needed to kneel, because if she didn't kneel, she was going to leave the church quickly, and just as quickly she was going to find a drink. It was the only thing left to her. If there was going to be any rescue, it was going to have to come from her. But these people didn't think so. This small congregation praying along with the priest. They believed something else entirely. And she wanted to believe in something because she could no longer believe in herself. She murmured, "Oh, please, oh, please, oh, please." Upon the third please, she began to weep.
May 22, Ludlow, Shropshire. The first phone call came from the Assistant Commissioner, and Linley knew better than to let it go to voicemail. Hillier's good morning consisted of, "Where the hell are we after 6 days?" Linley decided not to point out to the AC that technically it was only 5, or at most 5.5 days, since one of them had been nearly taken up with driving to Shropshire via West Mercia Police Headquarters. Before he could formulate an answer of any kind, however, Hillier went on, "I've had Quentin Walker phoning me for an update. He's making noises about the Home Office, although God knows what he thinks that fool of a Home Secretary is going to do about moving things along in the desired direction, whatever the hell that is. So where are you with this, and what have you and the redoubtable Sergeant Havers accomplished?" Linley could picture Hillier's florid face taking on even more colour as he spoke. That the man was tense was historical fact. That he'd not yet had a stroke was something of a miracle. He replied with, "We're narrowing things, sir." "What the hell does that mean?" "We think the Ludlow PCSO might be someone's dupe." "What someone?" Linley didn't want to say the Deputy Chief Constable for fear Hillier would experience apoplexy. So he went with, "We're not at the point of questioning anyone, sir, but we're having a much closer look at the crime scene today, and we're meeting with the forensic pathologist." "So the death is suspicious. Am I meant to tell Walker that?" "It might be suspicious." "What the dickens is 'might be' supposed to buy me, Inspector?" "I reckon it's supposed to tell you not to say anything to the MP if you can possibly avoid it." "Do I take from that advice the uplifting information that suspicious death isn't going to discourage Clive Druitt from getting out his checkbook and ringing his legal team? Just now it could well do the opposite. You know where that leaves me, don't you? I'm left with saying, they're moving things ahead, and I'll be in touch." "I'm afraid that's the situation, sir." "Christ, I'm sorry I rang you." On his end, Hillier cut the call. From the incoming number, Linley knew the AC had made it from his mobile, which had unfortunately robbed Hillier of the ability to bang down the receiver, as he no doubt would have liked to do. Linley had just finished shaving when the second phone call came through. He'd let go, hoping to hear from Deirdre, so he was unsurprised to see that it was Nkata ringing him.
Clean as a newborn, were in Carter's first words. Have you ever witnessed a birth?
Haven't, Inspector.
Nor have I, just photos. Clean wouldn't be my word of choice.
Got it, right. But you know what I mean. Rochester, Henry Jeffrey, commonly called Harry, is exactly who he says he is. Professor of history who had to let it go. Panic attacks in the lecture halls, windows wide open in the dead of winter, all the rest. Only thing iffy is a loitering charge, but that went by the wayside long time back.
That's it, then? Nothing involving him and students, male or female or in between?
Not an itch to scratch. I did unearth why he's got this problem in the first place, though.
The claustrophobia?
Yeah, it's a rough one as well.
Linley walked to the window and opened the curtain. In the morning light he could see part of the castle. He noted that the banner announcing Titus Andronicus had lettering in which the uppercase letters both transformed into pools of blood beneath them. At least the audience would be forewarned, he thought. He said, "Is it relevant to what we're dealing with here?"
"Probably not."
And Carter went on to tell him. A father who was a genius when it came to electrical engineering, that father's belief in his genius being passed on to his son, an expectation that the type of genius would manifest in an identical fashion. When it did not, frustration attended by the determination that the son's lack of aptitude in science was actually a case of malingering.
Turns out his dad decides the way to show the kid the importance of electricity is to give him total darkness. Where they lived, he could only find what he wanted by putting him in a closed cupboard when his marks in science weren't what Dad thought they should be. That's where he spent midterms and holidays, up till he went to university, but by then damage was done.
Linley heard all this with a hardening of his spirit. Some day I'll get to the bottom of what's actually wrong with people's thinking, Winston.
Good luck with that, sir, was in Carter's reply.
How did you learn all this?
The clothes cupboard? Tracked down the sister. Point is, like I said, he's got no paddle in this particular canoe, in a manner of speaking. Nothing to hide and less to prove.
As in all the hotel rooms, there was an electric kettle, and Linley set it to boil water for a cup of early morning tea, as they continued to speak. He said, "Have you the time for another, then?"
"I can work it in here and there." "Who's on?" he replied.
"Gary Ruddock, the PCSO. Apparently he has a background that might be illuminating, according to what he told Barbara when she was here earlier. A cult in Donegal. I've no idea whether it's worthwhile to have a go with that, but Hillier rang me earlier, and should he ring again, as he's likely to do, having something to give him would probably save him from self-defenestration."
"Sir?"
"Throwing himself out of his office window." And Carter laughed.
"I'm on it, then. Be in touch."
And he rang off. Before the third call hit his mobile, Linley was able to dress, descend the stairs and have breakfast with Havers, who swore on the life of her pet cat, an animal that Linley knew very well she did not possess, that she'd spent an hour practicing in order to overwhelm Dorothea Harriman with her dancing expertise. When that third call came, they were on their way to the police station. As he was driving, Linley took the phone from the breast pocket of his jacket and handed it to Barbara. She looked at its screen.
"It's herself," she said. "You want—"
He didn't. Isabel Ardrey was the last person he wished to speak to, as there was no depending upon what kind of condition she was in. He said, "Let it go to message. We can listen to it later."
"My thought as well," she replied.
They told Ruddock that another look at the office in which Ian Druitt hanged himself was in order. The PCSO had seemed surprised by this request, but he'd agreed to meet them at the station in advance of his regular walkabout. He was there when they arrived, although instead of waiting for them in the car park, he'd left the station door open for them. They found him in the former lunchroom, tinkering with an old microwave.
"Sounds like you're making progress,"
were his first words to them. "Now if I could do the same with this bloody thing." He placed his hand on top of the old oven.
"Thing's an antique, more or less, but sometimes it still does the job," he said.
Linley said they'd just have a quick look at the office where Druitt died, and then they'd be on their way.
"You know where it is,"
Ruddock said. He didn't appear to feel the need to go with them. The office was as it had been before, although not as it had been in the photos. A rolling desk chair was in place of the plastic chair that had been in the office the night Druitt died. That was, however, the only change. The bulletin boards gave them no additional information, nor did a waste paper basket or the small gouges in the walls where frames had hung. There were marks on the lino where other furniture had once stood, but the shape of the marks suggested filing cabinets, possibly two sets of bookshelves, potentially a credenza as well. Other than that, the fact that the lino had seen hard use was not surprising, considering the age of the building. Havers remarked,
"Looks like someone else was doing their dancing practice round this place, you ask me."
"Ah, you see, you're not alone." He was examining the Venetian blinds when she said, "We didn't see this first time we were here, for what it's worth, sir," although she sounded far less than hopeful. Linley turned to find that she was squatting at the desk's knee-hole, having pulled the rolling chair away from it. He went to see what she'd found. Scuff marks, he saw, of the sort that rubber-heeled shoes would make over time when one pushed back from a desk. He looked from them to her. She said, "All right, I know. Could be someone gave up fags and was beating his feet on the floor. Did you do that, by the way?"
"When I gave them up?" he said. "No. I gnawed on my fingernails for 2 years."
"See? There you go, sir. I'm sticking with them, I am. Wreaking havoc on my manicure is not going to happen."
She stood. They went to the cupboard door from whose knob the deacon had strung himself. It was sturdy, not the type of knob that would have been made loose by having to hold the weight of a man. From there they surveyed the room again.
"Dead men and tales," Hafer said with a sigh.
"Would that were not the case," Linley said.
They returned to the lunchroom. Ruddock had the back of the microwave removed. He looked up from his work and appeared to register something on one of their faces, because he said,
"No luck, then?"
"We're not certain," Linley told him. "There's something that could be odd."
Ruddock set his screwdriver to one side.
"What's that, then?"
Linley told him about the photos taken by Socko in the immediate aftermath of the deacon's death.
"What can you tell us about the chair?" he asked Ruddock, going on to explain. The overturned chair, the fact that it was a plastic one, the additional fact that it was not a desk chair, and that, come to think of it, it probably wouldn't have been a suitable height for someone working at the desk at all. After a moment for thought, Ruddock shook his head.
"I never thought anything about that chair. It was what was in the office when I put him there. I mean, he had to sit on something, and that was in the room. There wasn't anything else. I know how he got overturned, though. I had to stretch him out on the floor for CPR. I shoved the desk out of the way and the chair probably toppled. I was... well, I suppose I panicked."
Considering that he'd already confessed to what he'd been doing out in the car park, this was hardly surprising. But there was still that issue of the woman he'd been with. Linley said to him, "Gary, we've a witness to your having college-age girls with you at night. In your patrol car, this is. Can you tell us about that?" The PCSO seemed to hesitate. Then he said,
"I expect that's to do with the drinking. When they're pissed enough, it's always seemed dangerous for them to be out in the streets on their own. I stow them in the car and get them back where they belong. Doesn't happen every time I'm dealing with bingers, but it does happen, so I'm not surprised someone saw me with them."
"This would be a her, not a them," Barbara pointed out.
"Well, I'd deliver them home one by one," he said. "So I'd end up with one, a her or him, at the end, since most of the students round here live with their parents, or in small accommodation like a bedsit or a room that's let in someone's home."
"Is this part of the job?" Linley asked him. "Asked to do this by the town council or the mayor?"
"Just seems sensible. A way to avoid future trouble. Plus it helps nip things in the bud. With the drink, I mean. I don't like to see the kids heading down that rabbit hole, if you know what I mean. It's easier to do at that age, and I reckon if their parents see them blotto often enough, they're going to do something about it. It's not part of my job, though, obviously."
"Is Dina Donaldson one of the drinkers?" Linley asked.
"Oh, she is, that one. She's called Ding, by the way. She's one of the kids who lives in accommodation instead of with her parents. She's got a real problem with the drink, she does. And last thing she wants is me telling tales to her mum and dad. I keep her in order by making sure she knows that I'm one hair away from carting her home to them."
"You've been seen with her in the car park here," Linley said.
"At night, this is."
"Not surprising, that.
I've brought her here more than once, to have a word. It's not like I want to drag the girl to her parents' house. What with the distance, as they don't live local, and with trying to be a decent cop. I mean, helpful, the way local constables have always been. So I brought her here for a lecture on what's going to happen if she doesn't bloody stop it all, like she's probably going to die, if you know what I mean. And while things have improved, I mean, she's let up a bit, sometimes the drink gets away from her, and there we go again."
"That sounds like something beyond the call of duty," Havers pointed out.
"When the kids drink, they cause problems. Town residents make an issue of it. They get on the phone and there you have it. I'd like to put a stop to it all, and I'm doing what I can."
"Like Mr. Druitt?"
He cocked his head, as if unsure what the reference meant.
Havers said, "He wanted a street pastor's program here, picking up the kids when they're pissed and giving them coffee and soup and whatever. He didn't manage to get far with that, though."
"That's only part of the shame of his dying, you ask me," Ruddock said.
Church Stretton, Shropshire.
along with the vast highland moors of the Long Mynd, the volcanic, rolling Stretton Hills created a valley into which the Victorian town of Church Stretton sat. It resembled what it once had been, a 19th-century health resort, where ailing individuals once had come to take the mineral waters of the area. Over more than a century, however, the town had greatly altered, morphing from a spa for the sickly into a centre for the hale and hearty. With rucksacks on their backs and collapsible hiking sticks in their hands, these enthusiastic individuals now climbed the heights of the Long Mynd, looking for the views that stretched well into Wales. When Barbara Havers saw the country walkers gathered in the streets, she said irritably, "Better them than me. What's happened to people? Where are the good old days?" "True," Linley said, and she could hear the sardonic tone he employed. "Those good old days of gout and tuberculosis were far better, Sergeant."
"Don't you start," she warned him. "What am I looking for again?"
"It's called Main Event, M-A-N-E.
I hate clever names as well. Have I mentioned that?"
"Do you need a cigarette? Is that what this is about?"
"It's about him, it is. She was with him, sir. That girl. Dina. Ding. Whoever."
"He didn't deny it, Havers. And it does seem we know the reason why. If, of course, he's telling the truth."
"So is he lying about the other? The married one, or whatever she is?"
"Possibly. His mind must be whirling now, though.
All those phone calls to Trevor Freeman, sir? They could be a good way to hide the fact that he was bonking the wife and using the husband's phone to make arrangements. How many people check their own phones for calls that have come in to someone else? Would you think of that?"
"I wouldn't." "Of course, you have Denton to worry about, eh? Him making and getting calls on your mobile from New York, Broadway on the line and all that, or Hollywood?" "There's always Hollywood to consider," Linley agreed. "There it is, by the way.
The Main Event? Sorry, sir, got distracted."
When they walked into the place, Barbara decided that to call it a hair salon would be stretching things. While it did contain two chairs suitable for cuts and colouring, having more than one stylist working at once would certainly turn a workday into a battle of elbows. The salon barely contained the client and stylist it currently held. This was where Nancy Scannell had said she would meet them for their conversation. Linley had told her that a hair salon wouldn't actually make the top 10 of his list of choices for the coming interview, but she had explained it was this or waiting till after her court appearance later that day. As it was, she'd practically had to sell her firstborn child in order to set up this appointment. Getting in to see Dusty often took weeks. Not everyone could cut hair that curled like hers, and it was time for her summer do. The do was doing when they arrived. The forensic pathologist was in the chair. Dusty was fluttering round with two pairs of scissors and a comb between her teeth like a flamenco dancer with a rose. Hair was flying hither and yon. It seemed that Nancy Scannell had decided to go short, and Dusty was dead chuffed to accommodate her. She also wanted to colour it, they learned, once the comb was removed from between her lips. Scannell had apparently said no, but Dusty was after a compromise that involved,
"Just a wee streak of magenta, then. Nothing outrageous. You'll love it. You look ever so with it."
The pathologist wasn't having this, however. She liked the grey in her hair, she said. She'd certainly earned it during her marriage, and the less said about that, the better. Dusty gave Barbara and Linley a glance, most of her attention on Barbara's own hair. The stylist said,
"What have you done to yourself? Did you use a paring knife?"
"Nail scissors," Barbara told her.
"Can't help you, I'm afraid. Too dead short. You'll have to come back when it's grown out more." "I'll make a note of that in my diary," Barbara said.
Then to the pathologist, "This is D.I. Linley, Dr. Scannell."
"So I thought," she said. "Let's get to it."
Here, Linley, Barbara reckoned, had probably assumed that while they had arranged to meet the pathologist at her hair salon, they would certainly decamp for their conversation elsewhere.
"How it has to be, if you want it today," Scannell said. Then she added to Dusty, "Have the earbuds?"
"All right, hang on then." Dusty fished in a nearby drawer and brought forth the earbuds, which he then plugged into a mobile phone, apparently accessing music to prevent eavesdropping. Within seconds, her head was moving to a beat. It made no difference to her expertise with the scissors, it seemed, for onward she went, clipping and scalping and assessing the style as the rest of them chatted. "We've been to the office in the station where Ian Druitt died," Linley told the forensic pathologist. "We've been through your report. We've also studied the autopsy pictures. How confident are you that Druitt was a suicide?" She asked him to hand the pictures over, saying,
"It's been a good many months."
Barbara saw Dusty's expression become intrigued as she sneaked a glance at the Socco shots over the pathologist's shoulder. Then she averted her gaze and was all business once again. Scannell said,
the religious thing he used? It made the scene and the body trickier than normal.
She indicated the red stole on the floor near to the body.
Fabric doesn't mark the skin the way another sort of ligature would in a suicide. A leather or canvas belt, a length of robe, a flex of some kind. This thing, what's it called? I knew it one time, but my memory's getting more cluttered every year.
A stole, Linda said.
Ah, right. Anyway, it marked the skin. Here you can see in the photos from the autopsy. The petechiae are just visible. The bruising is faint, but it climbs the neck at the angle indicating self-harm. I told your sergeant this when she was last here, at the gliding centre this was, not at the salon.
Was the body strung up when you saw it?
The officer made it a wretched scene to gain much from. He'd done CPR on the man. One can hardly blame him for that. So, of course, he had to get him off the doorknob, and he had to remove the stole from his throat. But had he not done, there really wouldn't have been a different conclusion. Faking a death by suicide nearly always gets discovered.
She looked up at them from the chair.
And I take it that's what you're trying to do with this. Discover something. I wish you luck with that, but I still stand by my original report of suicide. Enough signs were there to declare it, from the contortions of the face to the bulging eyes to, as I said, the petechia. Not every possible sign, naturally, but every possible indicator in an unexplained death is rarely present, as doubtless you already know.
We've read your report, Lindley said. We can agree that the face and the neck are particularly indicative of suicide in the fashion he committed it. The abrasions round the wrists appear to be consistent with the PCSO's account of the arrest when he used them and why he took them off once they had reached the station. But since all of the signs of suicide weren't there, what else might have been? Scannell handed the photos and reports back to them. She tapped Dusty's arm to get her attention, then pointed to a spot on her head where part of her masses of hair, in her opinion, still apparently needed work. She said to Linley,
"With this kind of suicide, the doorknob bit, I mean, the legs often convulse. Considering where he was, there also might have been some kind of marking on the floor from those convulsions, which there wasn't. Of course, his legs might not have convulsed, or he could have been wearing shoes that don't leave marks in the first place. Most trainers won't mar a floor, but the lack of marks in and of themselves doesn't mean much when everything else is in order."
Barbara heard this with a sudden surge of energy. She said, "Sir?" to Linley, but he was already with her. "Do you mean scuff marks?" he asked Dr. Scannell.
"Yes. They could also be at the site of this kind of suicide, but as I said, convulsions aren't guaranteed, if you'll pardon the word, and they could have happened as part of the suicide without leaving evidence of themselves."
Barbara looked at Linley. He looked at her. Scannell caught the exchange between them, reflected in the mirror. She said,
"What is it?"
Linley said, "If the man was sitting in a chair, could someone standing above and behind him carry out a crime, a murder, and have it successfully pose as suicide?" She said slowly after a moment of reflection,
"That would probably put the stole in the right position to leave marks that encouraged a conclusion of suicide, yes, but I can't see it happening in that location, the office, without a mark on the floor indicating a struggle. And I certainly can't imagine the poor man sitting there and allowing himself to be done away with. Even with the handcuffs still on him, surely he would have kicked and writhed."
"Thus marking the floor," Linley said.
"Thus scuffing the floor," Barbara added. "Marking, scuffing, scoring, whatever."
Nancy Scannell nodded before saying,
"Sorry,"
to Dusty, who rapped her neatly on the shoulder for the movement.
"Yes, I'd say that with that scenario, there would be scuffing on the floor."
Bingo, huzzah, and all the rest, Barbara thought. They were back in business. Worcester, Herefordshire. It had been an easy matter to switch mobiles with Clover. They charged their phones every night, and as they had identical phones with the same unlocking code in the event one of them needed to use the other's phone in a pinch, all that was necessary was to make the switch, after first seeing to it that the wallpaper on his phone was the same as hers. That part was easy as well, since Clover wasn't a person to be bothered with selecting some personal and sentimental photo of baby, dog, cat to serve as a backdrop to the very few apps she took the trouble to sign up for. So finding the identical photo of rolling ocean waves in his own smartphone's offered wallpapers took less than 30 seconds. Trevor reckoned she'd work it all out at some point during her day, but he also reckoned that he had enough time to do the snooping that his previous day's conversation with Gaz Ruddock suggested wanted doing. For Gaz didn't produce falsehoods as well as he thought he did. Immediately after that conversation with the PCSO, Trevor had made a far closer examination of the calls into and out of his own phone.
He had easy access to 2 months' worth of calls since the phone stored them, and what the list told him was that from March 22nd until May 16th, calls to Gaz Ruddock and from Gaz Ruddock had been going out and coming in regularly. Like those he'd discovered on his earlier and more cursory examination of the mobile, these calls had been made or had come in at night or very early in the morning. There were days when this occurred only once. There were days when this occurred as many as 4 times. So after looking at what was available on his phone, he'd wanted to know more. While it was true that both Clover and Gaz had already claimed that their calls concerned their secret plan to keep a watch over what Finn got up to in Ludlow, the question was what sort of watching over warranted the number of conversations they'd apparently had. Trevor wanted some answers, and he began to assemble them by ringing his mobile's provider. He gave all the appropriate numbers and code words, telling the faceless and nameless voice at the other end that he wanted to check a few calls that a wayward child of his might have made. Then it was only a matter of waiting for the information to be sent to him. The interesting bit was obvious, once he had those records. The extensive nature of the Clover and Gaz communications via Trevor's own phone had begun on the 1st of March. Prior to that, and no matter how far back in time he went with the records, there was nothing on his phone to or from Gaz. It seemed damned odd that for someone meant to be watching over Finn, Gaz hadn't called Trevor's phone regularly to report to Clover until the late winter. That meant that prior to late winter he'd either been ringing Clover directly on her own phone, or he'd not been keeping an eye on Finn at all. Trevor wanted to make his own determination about that, which was what had led him to make the switch with his wife's phone. Once he'd studied her mobile's history and once he'd gone through the same process he'd used with his own phone to see even further back in time, he knew he couldn't wait till the evening to speak to Clover, so he rang his own mobile number and when she answered he said, "Sorry, we've done a switch with our phones, love," in the most casual tone he could manage. "Must have happened when we took them from their chargers."
"Have we?" she asked. "So that's why mine's not been ringing. I thought I'd finally got lucky enough to have a day without disturbances. Usually they start round 7:30 and don't stop. Has my phone rung, by the way?"
"Once I saw it was yours, I've been letting it go to message, but there have been enough calls that I realised I ought to let you know about the mix-up. Shall I play them, then? The messages, I mean?"
"Don't do that."
Was her response rather hasty, he wondered. He said, "Want me to bring it to you? I've nothing on at the gym till later, or we can meet halfway if you're able."
"I've one bloody meeting after another."
"I'll bring it to you, then."
"That seems like such a bother, Trev."
"It's no trouble. Shall I set off, then?" She said that if he would bring the mobile to Hindlip, she'd be ever so grateful. She'd meet him down at the reception building at the edge of the property. That way he'd have no need of going through the routine of sitting there waiting to be admitted. He agreed to this, although he knew that meeting her at that great distance from the administration building also served the purpose of allowing her conversation with her husband, should there be one, to be private. When he arrived at police headquarters, she was waiting for him. She emerged from the reception building, lifting her hand in a wave. She carried his mobile in it. He lowered the passenger window once he'd parked. When she came to the car, he said, "Get in." She looked surprised, although his tone hadn't been unfriendly. She said,
"I've only a few minutes, Trev."
He said, "This won't take more than that." When she was seated inside the car, she handed over his phone. He hung on to hers. She didn't fail to notice. She cocked her head curiously. He said, "This business with the phones." When she made no reply, he went on, "It was deliberate. I switched them." He looked over at her. Her expression hadn't altered, nor had she moved. She said,
"Ah,
are you going to ask me why?"
"I assume you've come here to tell me. I must say, though, I don't know why this couldn't have waited till I got home."
That was bravado in action. Trevor wondered why he'd never noticed the degree to which his wife could dissemble. He should have done. She'd been going at the sex games for years, and in every scenario her performance had been utterly genuine, which was what had made it so arousing. Schoolgirl, nun, whore, railway ticket agent, deliverer of the post, yoga teacher, hotel maid. Clover didn't pretend. She became. He was going to have to watch her now, like a specimen under a microscope. "I went along with the lie to the Met, as ordered," he said. "But it made me want to know a bit more about all these phone calls to and from Gaz. I don't think you can blame me for that. If I'm going to lie to the police, it's good to have at least a partial idea of what the truth is. Otherwise it all gets difficult. Keeping everything straight, I mean. But you know this, don't you, as you're a cop?"
"Have we not already dealt with this?"
"We have, in part.
but you know how curiosity works on a person. Could be it's because I'm married to a copper like I am, but what happened is that my head started working on those calls, and I reckoned the best way to get it to stop working was to take a closer look at him. I mean, Jesus, Clover, it was like a perpetual motion machine was banging on inside the old bean. Her eyes narrowed. She wasn't fooled by his casual tone, and he didn't actually expect her to be. She said, "Yes, that does make sense. A lot has been asked of you. I'm glad you see it that way. So you're likely to be on board with my looking at all these calls to and from Gaz, trying to work out why there have been so many on my phone. When Finnegan... Oh, I've got all that. I've put an end to it, by the way, this watching over Finn business that you and Gaz have going on." He made air quotes, and she did not fail to pick up on them. She said, "Are we going back to that other, then? Me hot and bothered to get Gaz between my legs, and Gaz all hot and bothered to be there? The two of us planning our trysts by using your phone?" "I'm not saying that, am I, Clover? But here's what it is. I'm beginning to think you want me to say it."
"I don't want you to say anything except what's on your mind."
"That being the case, what's Finn done that you don't want me to know about?" She looked away from him. A car had just pulled up to the reception kiosk. She studied it as if searching for a detail she'd been ordered to be on the lookout for. A middle-aged woman got out, carrying a handbag the size of which was going to warrant extreme examination. Were this a prison, she'd have a Victoria sponge inside of it, and inside the sponge she'd have a crowbar. Clover sighed heavily.
"I don't know what else to say to you, Trev. We seem to keep going round and round. I've nothing more to give you on the subject.
Try thinking back to the beginning of March." She turned back to him. She looked genuinely puzzled. He went on, "That's when the nighttime phone calls from Gaz started coming in on my mobile and going out from it. So if you and he are having matters about Finn, there's been at least one each night on my phone since the beginning of March. Now, if all these conversations between you and Gaz are called for, and if the reason's Finn, I want to know what he's done, but I want to know it now." She grasped the handle of the door, saying as she lifted it,
"I don't know what you're accusing me of, or who you actually think I am, but I think we've said enough, Trevor."
"Not quite. We haven't talked about your phone yet."
"I don't see where that's going to get us."
"That's what you actually believe." "I ask because there are 8 calls between you and Gaz Ruddock on your phone, Clover, made on the 26th and the 27th of February. Then they stop altogether, and start up on my phone. So the way I look at it, either something happened prior to or on the 26th, or you and Gaz came to some sort of arrangement that meant no more ringing each other unless you had access to my mobile." She gave a disgusted shake of her head.
"Yes, all right. Have it as you like. We've been going at it as often as possible. I need a younger man because you're not enough. Is that what you want to hear?
What I want to hear is the truth. If Finn's done something, I want to know what it is."
"What on earth could he possibly have done?"
"Druitt had his concerns, right? Drugs, alcohol, children, whatever. Is that what's been going on?"
"For God's sake, Trevor, for all you and I know, that's complete rubbish. Do I need to remind you that we have only Gaz's word that he and Druitt wanted to speak with us at all?"
"Are you saying that Gaz wants Finn stitched up for something?"
"I don't know. All I know is that life in Ludlow hasn't gone as well for Finnegan as he'd like us to believe. He's been drinking too much and smoking weed and missing lectures and tutorials. He may well have gone on to heavier drugs. Gaz was letting me know about everything as it developed. Then when Ian Druitt died, he began to think whatever it was that he thought, because I wouldn't let him even say it, all right? But I had to take his course because of Finnegan. Now do you see the position I've been in?"
He'd been holding back his final piece of information because he didn't want to think about it, let alone to bring it up. But he saw that he had to do so now. "There were 3 calls on the night that bloke died, Clover. I checked the dates."
"What are you talking about?"
"A call from you to Gaz, and 2 calls from Gaz to you, that same night Ian Druitt died." She stared at him. She did open the door then. He thought she meant to get out without another word, but he was wrong. She said,
"So you're suggesting, I take it, that Ian Druitt wasn't a suicide at all? That he died either at my hand or by my orders, yes?"
She waited. When he said nothing, she went on,
"What do you take me for, Trev?"
The reply came to him absolutely unbidden. "I don't know," he said. "And that's the devil of it, Clover." Ludlow, Shropshire.
"I knew he was dirty," were Havers' words as they parked in Teamside.
two wheels and most of the Healy Elliot on the pavement. They waited for a moment to let traffic pass before they crossed over the street.
"I don't think we can go quite that far, Barbara," Lindley replied. "He's soiled, perhaps. Dirty, however. We're not there yet."
"Come on, Inspector. The scuff marks, the chairs, the handcuffs on and the handcuffs off, anonymous phone calls, CCTV cameras that get shut off for 20 seconds and then have their positions switched, college girls being carted round town for whatever reason, pubs being rung, women being bonked. What more do we need?"
"For a start, we need to consider the 19 days that elapsed between that phone call and the death of Ian Druitt. Then we must consider what it means that those 19 days were brought to an end by Finnegan Freeman's mother. After that, we must consider what that detail means."
"All right. I'll see your point if I have to. It means Finnegan's in it, or his mum, or his dad, or Ruddock, but in any case, someone in the DCC circle."
"Which is why we need to know who, if anyone at all, was with Ruddock in the car park on the night of the murder."
"Perhaps it was Colonel Mustard with a sodding candlestick," she muttered.
Lindley chuckled. "I'm glad you see my point." He glanced at his pocket watch. The day was getting on. Hillier wanted a result. Soon. If this went to the Home Secretary's desk, there was going to be a problem that none of them were going to want to deal with. When his mobile rang, his first thought was that his mind had been read in London. He gave it a look and saw he wasn't far off wrong. It was Ardrey. He didn't want to get into a conversation with her just now. He knew he ought to answer because of everything he'd learned from Dee Harriman about Isabel's condition, but the fact was that he needed to keep his mind on the matter in hand, which was complicated enough already without any intrusion from the DCS. He let it go to message. Havers saw him do it. He said, "The DCS again."
She said, "Better you than me,"
which was when her own mobile rang. She gave it a look and then said,
"Bloody hell, should I—"
They could hardly both avoid the DCS. He said, "Assess her condition."
"What should I say about you?"
"I've gone wherever I've gone, and you'll give me the message when you see me."
"And where have you gone?"
"Sergeant, it's unlike you to fail in the area of creative alternatives at this 11th hour. If by any chance she's ringing about the case, which she probably is, let her know we're closing in."
From there, he heard Barbara's end of the conversation only, which consisted of,
"Gav? Just about to have—" "Huh? He's out and about."
"Got started early.
Like I was saying, we're wanting a chat with whoever happens to be at home in Teamside, either Finn Freeman or his housemate. That girl Dina? Well—" "Oh, no. Sorry. Manner of speaking. It's only me. He's gone to—"
She apparently saw the problem with a specific place and the possibility of being out of range and hence unable to take Isabel's call because she quickly switched to,
"He's tracking down the forensic woman again for—" "Hang on, Gov. We've already done that twice, me and the inspector, okay? Right? I'll have another look. I can do it later and give you a ring, okay?" "Will do, ma'am."
She rang off and shot him an aggrieved look.
"She sounds like she's had 15 cups of coffee. She wants us looking at the Socco photos another time. And to ring her while we're doing it. You ask me, she's trying to tiptoe out a cow dung without her shoe sole stinking."
"It costs us little enough to cooperate. I'll ring her later."
"Look at you,"
Havers said with a scowl as she shoved her mobile back into her bag.
"Do you ever get tired of being the gent?"
"It's beat into one from childbirth, Sergeant."
"Ah, we appear to have arrived just in time."
He gestured towards the house, where the girl Ding had opened the front door. She wore a rucksack and she headed straight for a bicycle. She fiddled with its lock, which appeared to be stiff. When they got closer to her, they could hear her muttering,
"Oh, come on, come on!"
"Would you like help?" Lindley inquired. The girl swung round. She did a back step at the sight of them. She said,
"Finn's not here." "Which is fine," Havers told her, "as you're the person we want to have a word with."
The girl was instantly suspicious. Her gaze darted between them like a bird hopping between two branches.
"I know Francie Alamucci put me into it, if that's why you want to talk to me," she said. "It might help you to know Francie or bonk anyone."
"This actually won't take long," Lindley told the girl. "And you're right. By the way, Francie Adamucci did mention you. The PCSO confirmed her words. But we'd be interested in hearing your side of things."
"They're both lies, and I don't have time."
"Right, who does?" Havers asked.
"I was going to say I don't have to talk to you. Anyway, I'm expected at home."
"This would be the home where your parents are?" Havers went on.
"This would be the place you don't want Gary Ruddock casting you to?" "Who said that?" she demanded.
"The man himself. He says it has to do with your problem."
"What
problem.
"If you'll allow us a few minutes, we'll explain," Linley said. She stalked back to the door and shoved it open with some emphasis. She walked into the house but made certain they knew from her posture that she wasn't intending to move an inch from the end.